Warning, this episode contains descriptions of violence. Listener discretion is advised. It was April 23rd, 1993, and it was an otherwise quiet night for the Colony Police Department in upstate New York. Rick Easton, a local TV cameraman, was embedded with the Colony PD that night for a news piece on Operation Main Street.
So I had been trying to set up this ride-along with the Town of Colony Police Department for probably a couple of months. They had this program called Operation Main Street, and basically they would drive around to the busy sections of Colony where there were a lot of bars and restaurants and try to catch people doing drugs in their cars. It was a kind of a zero-tolerance kind of program they had going. So after a while, they said, you know, okay, and I was able to join them on a Friday night, and I show up at the Colony Police Department. I met two of their officers, Dave and Mark. They were dressed in plain clothes, and I got in their unmarked car, and we just started driving around the town of Colony.
At 10:43 p.m., just down the road, Jennifer Rhodes, a star tennis player from Hunter High School, and her mother, were returning home from a tennis tournament to the Sheraton Inn on Wolf Road. For junior tennis players, tennis tournaments are a way to move up in the rankings, a key metric for any tennis player hoping to play on a collegiate level. Tournaments take you all across the state, and for some good enough at the sport, the country. Jennifer was ranked 13th in the Eastern Tennis Association's Girls 18 and Under division. As her mother locked the car, Jennifer began walking to their room through the side parking lot. A stranger, pushing a wheelchair, wearing a trench coat, green scarf, and dark glasses, began to follow her. She felt nervous, but don't be ridiculous, she thought to herself. Her instinct was right. The stranger ambushed her and began beating her with a club. The police would describe it as a C-battery-sized flashlight. It turned out to be a cattle prod. Her mother ran from the car to stop the attack. She pulled the attacker from Jennifer and told her to get help. He then started attacking her mother. "I don't want to leave you," Jennifer screamed at her mother. Her mother implored her to run. On her way to get help, Jennifer heard her mother yell, "If you hurt my daughter, I'll kill you. I'll kill you." Jennifer ran to the front desk, screaming, "Help me! Help my mother!" Paul Abair, the front desk employee at the time, ran out with Jennifer. They arrived at the scene. "Leave her alone," a bear shouted at the stranger. It was a bloody mess. Her mother would soon receive 80 stitches. Jennifer later received 10 stitches. The wheelchair the stranger pushed had a blanket on it. Underneath the blanket was a gun, which the stranger took and pointed at a bear. A bear backed down and said, "Okay, pal, what do you want me to do?" The stranger ultimately got in his car and sped off. An hour later, he'd check in across the street at the Turf Inn. He spread some of his belongings in the grass behind the hotel. Police said they found a mask, 7 wigs, 12 pairs of handcuffs, an 8-inch hunting knife, a leather muzzle, dog leashes, a stun gun, shotgun shells, 9mm ammunition clips, a voice disguiser, and a tennis racket. The man was panicking, and just after midnight, the car Rick Easton was traveling in got a call for backup.
And I think it was a little after midnight, and we're probably not back in the car for more than a couple of minutes, and we get called to be backup. I'm thinking maybe another patrol came across a big bust and they want to get it on camera. So we head to the scene. It was a parking lot for a store called Calico Corners. It was on Wolf Road, which is a pretty busy area. It's near the airport, so there's lots of hotels and bars and businesses. So we get there pretty quickly. It was probably less than 3 minutes away. Mark is driving, Dave is in the passenger seat, and I'm in the back seat with my camera rolling.
141-110.
As we roll up, the unit that was already there has its spotlight trained on this big white Lincoln that's parked in the back of the parking lot.
Why don't you stand there with all the lights on?
I don't know.
Mark passes the other cop car. As he gets a little closer, Dave's trying to figure out what's going on.
Well, he's doing it. He's shuffling around inside. What's going on?
Mark kind of rolls up toward the rear of the car, and we start to get out.
He looks a little bit strange here.
Dave's hand reaches for his hip like he's going for his gun. There's a dog barking from the other cop car. I'm stumbling to get out of the back seat with this 20-pound camera that's on my shoulder. As I get out, you can hear Dave yell out,
"He just shot himself."
At 1 a.m. on Saturday, only 145 minutes after the attack, the stranger, Gary Walensky, shot himself through the mouth. Although his terror ended, the investigation into his life was only beginning. It turned out, Jennifer knew the stranger quite well. How did Jennifer's tennis coach, beloved by so many New York families, become so evil? What were the signs along the way? And could this have been prevented? This is Crossover. Roslyn, New York is exit 37 on the Long Island Expressway, only 45 minutes from Manhattan, but a far cry from the city. It's quiet and picturesque, and in the 1950s, charming ranch homes adorned the streets. It's where Gary Walensky grew up. Here's Gary's classmate from Roslyn High, Ed Rosamondo.
We all came from rather upper middle class homes. The typical home we lived in was a ranch home. The ranch homes were very popular in those days. And everybody had two cars. There was a reasonable amount of disposable income.
It was the sort of town any family could move to and be happy. And that's how Neil Pilson felt when he arrived in Roslyn for high school after growing up in Queens. And it was here that he met his childhood friend, Gary Walensky.
Roslyn was a very small high school compared to some of the other schools. We had a class that was mixed with students who were interested in college, going on to college, and other students who were basically interested in a career that didn't involve college, but involved areas like construction and gardening or landscaping, stuff like that. So we were a mix.
Gary Walensky joined the tennis team, as well as the basketball team, where he was a top scorer.
Gary, with his car and his relatively more mature age, was a well-known person within our school. He was also an outstanding athlete. I believe he either led or was second in scoring for the basketball team. And he was either number one or number two on the tennis team. So he was known as a good athlete.
As good of a tennis and basketball player he was, Gary was also a skilled dancer.
We had a dance club and actually ended up on one of the television dance shows. We all went into New York on a bus and we danced as part of an ongoing television series.
Gary had a dance partner who he would practice with in her basement.
And they would be the center of attraction at high school dances. The Lindy Hop was the big dance at the time, and it involved swinging your partner, flipping her over your shoulder, dancing, swinging her out with one arm holding her and she's 6 feet away. There were quite a few moves that were practiced. And Gary and his dance partner would actually have practice sessions, because they told me about them, at her home in a basement where they'd practice their moves. Gary's relationship with this young lady was interesting because, as I mentioned, while she was his dance partner, I don't recall them ever dating.
When she would come back to school after practice, Neil became concerned.
She also, on at least one, and I think perhaps two different occasions, showed up in school with some evidence of bruising around her face. Black eye, scratches, things like that. In private conversations with other friends, we were concerned. We wondered about that, but we never pursued it. I don't recall ever asking her directly what happened, but I personally had a suspicion that he may have hit her.
It's not something Neil has revealed until now.
It was a source of some mild concern at the time, and I recall it. I recalled it when I was first contacted by reporters at the time of Gary's death. But I didn't mention it. At least I don't recall mentioning it. But when you got in touch, I thought I'd mention it because it's obviously a potentially relevant point in trying to determine Gary's future life and his ultimate death.
Gary's parents were divorced. Gary lived with his father. His mother lived in Roslyn too, but Gary once told a friend that his mother had died. He seemed to be embarrassed about his arrangement.
I was aware that his parents were divorced. I think I was aware that he was living with his father. One of the curious things about Gary was that we had no idea where he lived. We were never invited to his home. Unlike all of the other guys in our group, where we'd meet at each other's houses, where we'd be invited in, the parents would offer us cookies and soda. We never, ever, none of us, because we used to ask each other, none of us knew where Gary lived, none of us knew were at his house.
Neil would double date with Gary, as Gary was one of the first in his friend group to obtain a license.
Gary's big achievement, if you call it that, while we were in high school, is Gary got his junior license at age 16 while I think we were sophomores.
Ultimately, Gary's friend group all went off to top schools. Gary went to the University of Alabama.
Well, my immediate friends went to Amherst, MIT, and Penn. I went to Hamilton. Gary went to Alabama, which was kind of odd. Don't know why Gary chose it. I don't believe he graduated from Alabama.
He left after 1 year. He fell out of touch with his friend group. Many of them didn't hear from him ever again, and all were shocked when they did hear about him on the news in 1993. Summer camp is a rite of passage for children in New York City. Summers are not spent at home. They're spent in Maine and Connecticut and New Hampshire, on luscious acres with every sport imaginable and activities that rival most colleges. For Chad Meyer, Trip Lake Camp was a far cry from home in Iowa.
Yeah, because the previous 3 years I'd worked in UTAS and Corn and run a crew for that. And when I found the opportunity, I guess in college, it's my junior and senior year to do that, work at a camp instead, that was sounded like a lot more fun, even though I didn't make a whole lot of money, but it'd be working in the cornfield. So
he got the job after thinking he might want to be a teacher. As soon as he got there, he recognized three of the counselors were problematic. And his track record on calling out weird behavior was pretty good. One of them was fired.
Yeah, there's about three, him and a couple other ones, over the course of the first couple of weeks that I kind of realized were kind of a little different. Just kind of how they would stare at the girls was kind of creepy. That way you kind of look around and you see them. And I always kind of watch people and pick up on things. And that was one of the things that troubled me about Gary and this other guy, where just kind of watching shared kids that were, 13, 14-year-old girls. It was concerning. I would not have been comfortable with him around my kids.
Chad was shocked to turn on the TV less than a year later and see Walensky on the news.
So we've been out playing basketball and got in about, 7 or 8 o'clock or whatever it was. And just having to turn on a TV, which was just, we didn't have cable. And it was, I think, hard copies who had it. And, was sitting there getting ready to go to get a shower and stuff and started listening. It's about this guy who kidnapped a girl and one of his students and, they started talking about New York, and I'm like kind of paying attention halfway, and just started more and more stuff, and I'm like,
He just shot himself. A shocking end to a coach's obsession for his 17-year-old star player. This weekend, police say he tried to kidnap her and take her to a fortress straight out of Silence of the Lambs.
No way. There's no way this could be, you know, real. This can't be. Surely not. As soon as the story ended, and I'm like, holy crap, I know that guy, my brother. Like, how do you know him? I told him, you know, from camp and stuff. And like I said, if we hadn't seen that, I would have never known. It wouldn't have been like I've been Googling and looking to see what happened to him.
Until 1988, Gary had been a counselor at Point of Pines, which is where Nina Mohammed Noor met him in the summer of 1983.
Went to school in the States, so decided to apply for a summer job at Point of Pines. That's where I met Gary because he was the head of tennis at the camp.
She got to know Gary when she became his assistant of sorts and began helping him set up for his long days on the court.
I was his assistant because I was the one to set up the equipment and stuff in the mornings because the other counselors had to hustle their kids to breakfast and stuff. So my job was to get up a little bit earlier than everybody else, you know, set up the equipment on court and stuff.
Nina said Gary was the star of the camp, a showman, something that came up time and time again in conversations with Gary's colleagues.
He was really nice. He was really funny. He could tell really cool jokes. I mean, he played tennis on roller skates, put on a big show. You know, he was actually pretty much a showman. So I think that's how the kids thought he was like the coolest thing since sliced bread.
He even made shirts with him teaching tennis on roller skates that he gave to other counselors.
So even when we did our counselor show, I mean, there was about maybe, I would say, like, you know, 8 to 10 of us. And each of us had, you know, we all wore Gary t-shirts. So that's how many Gary on roller skates caricature t-shirts he had with him, you know. So we requested, we said, okay, look, we work for you. We're going to wear your t-shirts, have a little bit of fun doing the counselor show, a little song and dance in Gary t-shirts. So that was it. But then, you know, and I mean, he was fine with that and stuff. But, you know, so that was how, you know, he was like Mr. Cool Factor at camp.
Barry Bernstein, who grew up in Westchester and went to Point of Pines, also remembers the t-shirts.
He was always this happy-go-lucky guy. Everybody knew him. He was like the weird tennis pro. He used to draw. Like, I think if I hit the shirt was his drawing of himself.
But Barry also remembers feeling a little uneasy about the fact that Gary only taught girls. Girls' camps, girls' schools, girls' students.
I met him at this all-girls camp. And it, you know, he's a single guy at an all-girls camp. And I think you always just wondered about somebody like that a little bit more. People were like, he's a little weird. You know, it's one of the things you knew about him. Gary taught girls tennis, you know, a lot of the girls' schools. He was at an all-girls camp. But I remember being surprised when I heard about it, that I was like, wow, I don't think we ever thought it'd be that dark.
Nina noted that the act Gary put on for the kids didn't always last.
We knew he had a dark side because he was kind of moody sometimes. You know, he'd get really angry. He wasn't nasty or anything like that, but you could tell. But, you know, on the other hand, we all wake up on the wrong side of the bed. And when you're stuck in a summer camp with screaming children every day, I'd feel that way too.
Those mood swings would come to define Walensky's jobs over the years. But students put up with it. Because when you're the top instructor in New York, there's a lot people overlook. More after the break. Tennis underwent a boom in the 1970s, as more and more people picked up the sport. As the owner and operator of tennis centers across New York City, Skip Hartman saw it firsthand.
The early 70s was the beginning of the growth of indoor tennis around the United States. In the New York area, it was aided and abetted, so to speak, by the development of the air structure, because we don't have much land in the city where you can build permanent buildings, but you can put bubbles over public courts and so forth.
In the midst of this boom, Gary taught tennis in Central Park. He was known for teaching tennis on roller skates. At one point, he even opened up his own tennis shop called Tennis Lover at Lexington and 65th Street. He allowed people to practice their strokes in the back of the shop, outdoors, and watch themselves on video replay. Tennis was taking over, and according to Skip, It wasn't only the result of crafty real estate builders and entrepreneurs. Demographics were shifting, and women began taking a bigger interest in the sport.
The tennis boom that occurred between 1970 and 1980 was fueled by women from the baby boom generation deciding to give tennis a try. And that coincided, of course, with Gary at his peak as a clinician.
Gary started hosting tennis parties and clinics. In 1976, Tennis United, which was located on East 54th Street, took out a small classified ad in the New York Times, trying to bring in small and large groups to their facility, where Gary was a director. "Evening tennis parties, bring your racket," one ad read. Tennis United took over two floors between Hunter Elementary School and the Antiques Design Center on 54th Street. The ceiling was too low to lob, but people still showed up. Gary told the New York Times that 2,000 people played there during the week. Around this time, Skip hired Gary to coach clinics for a charity Skip started with Arthur Ashe.
Gary was a fabulous motivational speaker and coach, and we would hire him to do clinics for us, and he was great at it.
Gary actually wasn't that great of a player, but his job was to coach, not play.
And he was a showman. Gary was not a great tennis player. He was a decent player, but he had a very good eye. He was an excellent teacher.
Skip noted that Gary brought more to the court than the average tennis coach.
Well, besides his ability to make jokes and command a crowd, and he had sort of a routine he did, but like he would do things like teach tennis on roller skates. You know, he would do things to entertain people, and he was great at it.
Fredo Wayland, who coached with Gary at Midtown Tennis, also remembers just how popular Gary was.
As they say, his dance card was full. I mean, he had a ton of people there. You know, parents would take lessons too. It was mostly kids, but he did teach a bunch of adults. And, you know, it was a nonstop flow of people on the days when we were doing our junior groups for Midtown, that Gary would be teaching his own groups alongside of us.
After Fredo joined Midtown Tennis, Gary was quickly promoted.
He just had a bunch of kids he was teaching and bringing in a ton of traffic that wasn't, you know, our regular club. And he was offered the job to be the head pro.
Gary would recruit his students from summer camp to play with him at the club. And the antics didn't end in the summer.
And he was on the court and he would had all these tricks that he would do and all these gadgets that he would bring with him on the court. He'd bring hula hoops on the court. He had you would look over at Gary's court when he was doing a lesson and it almost looked like a carnival with all the equipment that he had and everything and all the, you know, sort of quirky stuff that he had going on. The rest of us were just feeding balls to kids and you look over and you never knew what you were going to see on Gary's court. You know, not in a bad way, but he was always looking for this, you know, it was his personality. I mean, he was a guy that taught lessons in the park on roller skates. So, you know, he was always doing some interesting things out there.
Gary embedded himself in his students' lives. He traveled with them to tournaments and become close with their families. Gary opened up to Fredo about his mom abandoning him, and it's part of the reason Fredo believes he became so involved in his students' personal lives.
Yeah, his mom had left when they were younger, and I think that had a big impact on him because he was always looking for to latch on more than as a tennis coach with the family, and he wanted to be like a part of people's family. So it seemed like he was always missing something and trying to replace it through his students.
Gary's skills as a coach were recognized. The U.S. Professional Tennis Registry named him the Pro of the Year in his region, and he was one of only a few Master Pros for the association.
He was a Master Pro, which is the highest you could get at that time in the mid-80s. I mean, there were probably only, maybe there was 20 or 30 guys, I think, at that time that were Master Professionals. And it wasn't because of his playing ability, because, I mean, I don't even think he played college tennis. If he did, it wasn't anything special, but he just had a passion for the game and became, you know, well connected teaching pro, and he was always participating with the USTA. So, you know, he was at their highest level. He would do the demonstrations when they had the USPTA conference somewhere up in White Plains, and Gary would be on the court there, and he would be teaching like what he does during his clinics to try to get other pros to use his philosophies.
But his management skills were less effective than his coaching skills. After Gary was promoted to head pro, some of Fredo's colleagues were shocked.
I'm not saying Gary wasn't, you know, a good pro, but we had other guys, and guys were like shaking their head, like, you know, what's this all about? And he came out and he had like a brochure of all these things that he was gonna have us teach in our clinics, and we were doing fine without him. Not to talk down on him, but everybody has different methods of teaching, and we did it our way. You know, my coach Bob Ryland, who was there, who coached Arthur Ashe and Venus and Serena and Leslie Allen and other top players, he had his way of teaching, and that's sort of what I did. And it didn't involve anything that Gary was going to do. So, I mean, obviously, if I'm told I have to do it his way, I would have done it. But that arrangement ended quickly. So it was kind of a relief. We didn't have to do that.
Gary was fired, and Fredo said it didn't end well. Fredo later learned there might have been another reason for his firing, one that was kept under wraps.
I had just moved back from Long Island, and I became assistant manager at Midtown. So I started working there. My wife and I moved to Westchester from out in the Hamptons. So I'd been away from Midtown for 3 years. And Gary's incident happened. And one of the guys working there that was a maintenance guy told me, he said that he had heard that Gary had a peephole in the closet of the coat closet between the men's and the women's locker room, and that he would go in there and look in the women's locker room.
For Gary Walensky, it was yet another moment he got away with a clear violation, and it seemingly only empowered him. But just a few years after getting fired at Midtown Tennis, the law would soon catch up with him. His arrest in 1988 is on the next episode of Crossover. On behalf of Maurer Media, I'm Henry Lynch.